Hi, podcast listeners. Really fascinating conversation today with the Irish Deputy Prime Minister. He's also the Foreign Minister. All about the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement and what a bad Brexit deal could do to Ireland. And that, of course, has a huge impact on the United States, which shaped that Good Friday deal 21 years ago. Next, Michelle talks to Democrat Anita Malik. So interesting to hear about her background in tech and why she's running for Congress in 2020. Then, I really enjoyed sitting down with the beloved British novelist Ian McEwan. You'll know him as the author of books like Atonement and On Chesil Beach, Enduring Love. Many of them became films. And now he's got a new book about today's challenge of AI. So enjoy the show, and for whoever's celebrating Easter or Passover, enjoy this holy weekend. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. 21 years ago, peace overcame conflict in Northern Ireland with the signing of the Good Friday Agreement between the UK and the Republic of Ireland, backed by the United States. The peace achievement was the jewel in the crown of American diplomacy during the Clinton administration. But now the accord is facing its toughest threat yet, and that's Brexit. Because of the risk of a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland being imposed again. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was in Ireland this week, pledging support for the Good Friday Agreement. And I sat down with her in Dublin for an exclusive interview, and she told me that this deal was a major achievement in the annals of American diplomacy, and Congress wouldn't tolerate any harm coming to it.
A US-UK trade agreement that would be a reward for weakening of the Good Friday Accords is just not a possibility. But maybe they can accomplish it without doing that. We just wanted to make sure they understood that as a consolation for leaving the EU, they're not getting the US.
A very clear message indeed. The Republic of Ireland welcomes it, such high-profile American support for that peace deal, as Foreign Minister Simon Coveney told me during our interview in Dublin. Foreign Minister, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
How important is this moment for you and for your country?
Well, I think it is a significant moment. I mean, we are celebrating the centenary of the birth of an independent state, if you like, in Ireland, which was a painful and violent and difficult birth. But it's one that has, many decades later, led to the modern, diverse, outward-looking island and Ireland that we see today. And that's something that my generation of politician wants to protect and enhance. And they are connections and relationships that we're celebrating with the visit of Speaker Pelosi to Ireland.
So I'm really interested because you say, you know, this independence, this peace that erupted out of violence, you're very, very committed to protecting. In other words, as we all know, the Good Friday Agreement between Ireland and Northern Ireland and Britain could be at risk because of Brexit. What has Speaker Pelosi been able to say to you that might assuage some of your fears?
So to really understand why that's a problem, you have to understand the Irish peace process and the conflict that led to the need for a peace process. And what I mean by that is that for many years, it was the physical border between Ireland and Northern Ireland that was a source of such friction. People were stopped and inspected by armed soldiers. It became a border where there was a lot of smuggling, there was a lot of gangland terrorism, and it became the symbol of the division of the island of Ireland. And so an all-island economy has developed on the back of that peace process and on the back of joint EU membership that has in many ways reinforced the peace process. So let me give you some examples. Every year, 500,000 lambs from farms in Northern Ireland come south of the border to be slaughtered. Every year, almost 40% of all of the milk produced on Northern Ireland farms come south of the border to be processed. Every year, tens of thousands of cattle are purchased by farmers and buyers in Northern Ireland south of the border and then taken north to be fattened and slaughtered. And that's just agriculture. And that movement and that commerce has built relationships and has built normal trading environments that has allowed a peace process to bed in and has allowed neighbours to talk to each other as people who trade with each other, as opposed to people who see themselves as coming from a different identity based on nationalism or unionism.
So the underlying message is that absent all of this, you could go back to a lot of friction and there could again be, I don't know, the economic imperative or the trade imperative, what, for war?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we need to be careful with how we describe the tensions around this. But certainly, we don't want to see the peace agreement and what has come from that start to be reversed and go backwards.
So this Good Friday marks 21 years since the deal, the peace deal, was signed.
That's right.
First, let me ask you about the United States and Speaker Pelosi, who seems to have told the British government, and indeed Prime Minister May, that Brexit will risk a UK-US so-called bilateral free trade deal. But most certainly, she said, if the Good Friday Agreement is compromised, there's no chance of a UK-USA trade deal, as all the Brexiters insist there will be some instantaneous deal. Does that give you comfort? Does that help? Does that put the wind in your back towards trying to get this resolved if the Brexiters don't believe that somehow there's going to be a magical immediate US trade deal?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I think everybody needs to be realistic about the length of time that it takes to negotiate trade deals. On average, it takes about 7 years. So the complexity of a trade deal between the EU and the US or the UK and the US in the future will take time. But I think people should remember here how the Good Friday Agreement came about and the role of the US in that, the role of people like George Mitchell and others. And so the peace agreement in Ireland, between Britain and Ireland, is owned by the US too. It's part of your investment. It's part of your success in terms of international diplomacy and the links between Ireland and the US and Britain and the US. You know, they're very, very close bonds, both politically and in terms of history. And so I think what Speaker Pelosi is saying, but also people like Richie Neal and others, it's not just one voice coming from Washington, it's a pretty strong message. And it's very clear that the Good Friday Agreement is valuable. It is an example to the rest of the world about how a peace process can work, how you need to keep working at it even decades later. And I think there would be a lot of concern in Washington if any deal that facilitates the UK leaving the EU were to fundamentally undermine a peace process that the US feels a real ownership and attachment to. And that is why I think you're getting such a clear message from Minister Pelosi. And from our perspective, you know, we're not asking the US to take sides. You know, we ourselves want the closest possible relationship with the UK. They're our closest neighbours, our closest friends. And we want to have a Brexit that they can live with, but that also protects core issues on the island of Ireland. And the fact that that view is shared in Washington, I think, is reassuring.
There's another view that's gaining a lot of currency, and that is, frankly, the breakup of the union. But also, it's happening on this island. There are think tanks, there are universities which are thinking about, you know, a united Ireland, yeah, thinking about how and what that would mean. Just give me a sense of where you think this is going.
We have been very careful to not to link the two issues of Irish reunification.
You may not be, but people
Brexit.
Are.
Yes,
think
some
tanks.
Are. Some are. Mm-hmm. And one political party in particular is. But what we're trying to do here is find a way forward that everybody can live with. Unionists and nationalists in Northern Ireland. And indeed a British and an Irish government. That provides for a prosperous, optimistic future for Northern Ireland and for the island of Ireland. If instead they crash out with no plan in place to deal with the consequences of that, in my view, the consequences for Northern Ireland are very stark and very negative. And we need to be honest about that. And the medium-term consequence of that, of course, is that if Northern Ireland is suffering, if unemployment is increasing, if the economy is damaged, if there's tension on the border with the Republic of Ireland, well, then nationalism in Northern Ireland will look for more extreme solutions. In other words, if a majority of people in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland vote for the reunification of Ireland, well, then it happens under the Good Friday Agreement.
Do you believe the extension to the end of October guarantees this deal, a soft Brexit, or a crash out and a hard deal? How do you view it here?
Well, I think a crash out and a hard Brexit is still unlikely because it's madness. You know, everybody loses if Britain crashes out of the EU. Britain loses the most. Ireland probably is next in line in terms of losing. But the rest of the EU is damaged as well. So if at the end of October, Britain crashes out without a deal, it will be an extraordinary failure of politics.
I just want to broaden this a little bit. I hope you don't mind. Ireland is a very popular country. It's on the world stage. It's a very popular country for people to come to. What happens here, you know, is viewed, you know, generally favorably, including the fact that you're trying to get a seat on the Security Council, and also that your prime minister is the first openly gay prime minister of the Republic and one of the few openly gay leaders in the world today. I wonder whether you can simply talk about how in this 2020 real election campaign in the United States, for instance, Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend has just announced, and he would be the first openly gay candidate, if he was successful, president of the United States. What do you tell nations about that issue and what it means today?
Well, I mean, I'm very proud of our Prime Minister, our Taoiseach in Ireland. He's a good friend of mine. He was also a competitor because we competed for the leadership against each other, but we've become good friends. But in many ways, he is a symbol of what Ireland is today, a modern, diverse, open country that's tolerant of difference, is no longer fazed by issues around sexuality. Our Prime Minister is half Indian, half Irish, so he's mixed race. And yes, he's openly gay, but he is comfortable with that. Ireland as a country is comfortable with that, although many people may see us from afar as a country that is more conservative in terms of religious values and so on. But I think it is a measure of how Ireland has changed, particularly in the last two decades. Our attitude to migration, our attitude to foreign nationals making their homes in Ireland. And we want to share that approach to how we see the world with other parts of the world, because in many ways, the story of Ireland in terms of our global nation, Irish people all over the world, is one of migration and change and tolerance and being part of new communities, whether it's in Buenos Aires or Boston. And I think that has led to not just a positive release in Irish society, if you like, but it's also led to economic development because so many people want to come here, live here, build global businesses out of Ireland because of that open approach towards difference. And it's something that I and the Prime Minister that I work with will work hard to develop further.
All right. Foreign Minister Simon Coveney, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thank you.
A message of progressive politics there from one of America's closest allies. And still to come on the programme, Britain's critically acclaimed novelist Ian McEwan, beloved around the world. The US 2020 election train is steaming full speed ahead. And while all eyes are on the presidential candidates, our next guest is running for a seat in Congress. Democrat Anita Malik is the daughter of Indian immigrants with a background in tech. And she wants to unseat the experienced Republican incumbent David Schwekert in Arizona's 6th District. She told our Michelle Martin how she plans to transform the traditionally conservative district.
So you decide to run, you throw your hat in the ring, figuratively speaking.
Yes.
You, against some people's odds, and here you are, you're a first-time candidate, you win your primary, you're running a very competitive race, you're within a couple of points of the incumbent, which was, you know, a lot of people kind of shocked by. Your race is starting to get a lot of national attention because you're like, wait, what's going on here? This is part of this kind of blue wave. And then, you know, the curveball. Your husband got sick. What happened? Tell us the story.
Yeah. You know, we had won the primary a couple weeks after that. I had my big first debate with the incumbent, and he was feeling sick. You know, we thought it was the flu, nothing to be concerned about, kind of on and off. But after that debate that Friday, I remember it very clearly, you know, that rest of that weekend took a very drastic turn. And there was personality change a little bit, but it was mostly just he wasn't functioning in a normal way. And I was running a campaign. Here I was the nominee. And so I tried to keep going. And a few days later, I realized that there was something really wrong. So still thinking it was the flu because, you know, his symptoms were flu-like. So I took him in to the doctor, you know, canceled some appearances. And they were concerned enough that they said, we don't know what this is, but you need to go in to the emergency room. It could be meningitis. What it ended up being was bacteria got into his bloodstream. They still do not know how it happened. It happens sometimes to people as a fluke. That bacteria went into his brain, and it caused 5 abscesses in his brain, which is very, very unusual to have that many, let alone for it to happen in the first place. So that started us off on, I don't even know the best adjective for that journey, but it was a journey that was very difficult to process because there weren't a lot of answers. You know, even these top surgeons didn't know always what to tell us. There was no answer of how this was going to turn out. And he was in the hospital for the next 6 weeks all the way through to Election Day.
I can't even think of any scenario where that would not have been frightening, exhausting, terrifying. I mean, he's your husband. He's the father of your kids. But on top of all that, you're trying to figure out how to run this campaign. What was the thought process? I mean, was there ever a point at which you thought about withdrawing?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the information came so trickling in about what was going on with him. What would the next step be? Which hospital was he moving to next, right? So every day was just putting one foot in front of the other and figuring out, how do I manage everything? Obviously, the kids were my number one priority. I had to pick of the 3 things that were happening where I would focus that energy. We had family with him so that I could be places where I needed to be, but also make sure I saw him every day and was there to talk to his doctors. And I talked to the party. I mean, I was honest about it. I said, what do we do here? You know, I'm on the ballot, but I want to do this. And in his moments of being aware, because I will tell you, in 6 weeks, it went up and down with different, you know, things that happen with the brain. That is normal. He doesn't remember a lot of it. But in moments where I knew he was with us and having those conversations, we talked about it. And he wanted me to see it through. You know, we are the type of family that believes, you know, we're that risk taker family, but we're also the ones that it's principle. There is so much wrong in this world. And I wanted to obviously have all the wins. I wanted him to be okay. And we wanted to win this race. But it was one of those moments where I just had to keep going. And I felt compelled that that was the right thing to do for everyone. I will say the community, my team were amazing. I had a lot of support. And knowing I had that support once we were able to communicate it a little bit gave me that ability to have that strength to do it.
So Election Day comes. You fall short. You fall short. You know, not unusual, first-time candidate running against an entrenched incumbent, you know, no disrespect to the incumbent, but the incumbents have advantages. You fall short. Then dealing with the aftermath, and this is one of the reasons we called you, is that you wrote you wrote about this in detail. The bills start rolling in. What was the shocker?
The shocker was I thought that I'd have, you know, 35 to 40,000 normal bills after insurance, after deductibles. You know, you have your 80-20, some things that they tagged on us, even though we were in network hospitals, but they were out of network physicians. But then one day I opened the mail to add to my pile and I received a bill for $142,000. Now, I was on insurance at the time.
Can I hear that again? $142,000?
$142,000.
That's not the cumulative.
No,
one bill.
That's one bill. Okay. Yes.
And what was that for?
That was for 10 days of hospital care. So none of the doctors at that time, all that separate. He had a surgery in that time frame, but that's separate, the surgeon's costs. So this was just for the hospital care. He was in the ICU, neuro ICU, and you know, you get that bill, and my first instinct was, I need to make a call right now. And I, you know, checked the time, and I called the hospital immediately. I tried to figure out what was going on. Why didn't insurance pay for this? I couldn't tell my husband. It took me about 2 days to tell him because he was going through this process of how did this all happen to me, you know, remembering things, trying to understand what's going on, and then also dealing with the bills that we thought we were going to manage, $30,000 to $40,000. And he was helping with that process and feeling, how did we get here, even for that amount, right? You know, I didn't go out and buy some fancy thing that I can't afford.
What did he say when you told him?
He handled it much better than I did, to be honest with you. You know, I really went through panic mode, and he listened to me. I told him all our options. I told him, you know, we can file a claim with the insurance. We'll work with the hospital. This is, you know, what the plan is. This is what we're going to do. And he looked at me. We were in our kitchen. I remember it distinctly. And he said, I'm just grateful to be here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to know that people, families, the people that go through the illnesses have to deal with this at the end, and to feel that that suddenly now you have a new burden, and it's a burden on your family as well. That's not okay. It's not okay.
One of the reasons that you ran for Congress is to defend and presumably shore up the Affordable Care Act. This is my understanding that you have insurance because you're an entrepreneur, and I believe your husband is as well, right?
Right, yes.
Through the Affordable Care Act. Now, some people would look at your situation and say, see, this is exactly the problem. The Affordable Care Act makes you kind of a serf of the land, right? You're tied to only one, you know, place, and you have very few options. It isn't doing what it's supposed to do, you know, and other people look at that and say, see, look, see what would have happened if this family hadn't had access to insurance through the Affordable Care Act. You know, what do you say about that?
Yeah, I think, like all policy, it's extremely complex. But the bottom line for us and for, I think, all families is the Affordable Care Act is not perfect. And we have to remember that. But to completely get rid of it and to say we're going to repeal it without a real solution to get to universal coverage is something I believe in, is not going to work either. For us, if we hadn't had the pre-existing conditions that are in place today, he wouldn't have even gotten any insurance. I mean, he now has a major pre-existing condition. If we were, you know, at a situation where, you know, it was a choice between, it really became a choice between life and debt, really, right? And life and death. And so for me, the ACA is not perfect and there's a lot of work to be done. And we have to remember that people have been pulling things out of it. You know, Arizona at the time when I had to choose a plan had one plan. And so that's the situation we were in. But guess what? I have insurance for my kids. We can go to all his follow-up care has been covered. We're not paying those high amounts. We have insurance. And so I'm grateful for it. I'm not angry at the system for this bill in terms of the ACA specifically. But I think that I am angry that we don't have more standards in place. We don't have more protections in place. And then we haven't moved to universal coverage so that people don't have to have this capitalistic sense of, well, you get what you pay for.
One of the things that you wrote about in your piece, in your blog post for Medium, is just how devastating it is to go through a serious illness, to be trying to take care of somebody, and these bills are coming, and now the financial worry takes over.
So
what's the answer to that? Is it universal coverage? Is it single payer?
It's a Medicare for all type system. It's universal coverage. My frustration is, talk about how we're going to get there. The reality is that families are facing this every day. Every day. And instead of actually making progress, building the ACA into that universal care model, into Medicare for all, making those steps, we can make those iterative steps. I guarantee you, if we could have that across the aisle conversation, if we really wanted to, if we were really focused on this microeconomic story of what's happening to families. That's why I shared my story, because I don't think we actually look at it from the family level.
But you do have the aspiration to be a policymaker. What's the answer? Is this single-payer health insurance, or is there some other model that you would embrace? And if so, what is that? What does it look like?
So I do believe in Medicare for all. I would embrace that. I would sign off on that. Every American deserves health care. It is a right. I'm firm on that. I always just want to say that, you know, how are we going to get there? Let's start working on it right now because I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated as not a policymaker, but as a voter and a constituent and a person that's struggling with that. But that is the answer. Without that, we can't start to improve our process. We can't start to improve people's lifespan. You know, there's a reason we don't focus on wellness and prevention here. So if we have universal coverage, if every single person has that healthcare baseline as a foundation, it doesn't mean we're not going to have other, perhaps, a private insurance market on top of that, you know, until we get to a full system. I think that that will take some time. But let's first give everybody insurance. Let's start there.
So the idea of Medicare for all means what? That there is a pool, there's an insurance mechanism that's available for people who can't get insurance on the private market or don't want to, and that what? Then there's a private insurance market on top of that? Is that the idea?
I don't think private insurance will entirely go away immediately. So that's why I say, yes, there might be some private insurance on top of that. I think that's okay. I would like to see that insurance market have more regulation and standards so things like the in-network, out-of-network problems don't happen. That happens on a very regular basis. We need to regulate that industry a little tighter, but I think it's not an exception to say that that's going to go away completely.
And as to the cost question, how is Medicare for All paid for, in your view?
Well, what I challenge people to look at when we talk about how is it paid for is what is the cost of everything right now? You know, what is the cost of people not having health care? That rises the cost of everything. And this is an economic issue, health care as a whole. And so how it's going to be paid for, I mean, there's a lot of things we can look at. We can look at our tax system. We can look at the way we tax capital gains. There's a lot of different ways. And if we have to remember, Medicare for All doesn't mean it's a complete handout. I think we should have subsidies for people that can't afford it. But it's a buy-in option as well. You know, this isn't a complete, like, let's give everything away for free. And people often forget that in the rhetoric around Medicare for All.
You've gone through this incredible experience. Well, I think the first question I think a lot of people are going to ask is, are you prepared to run again? You fell a little short last time. Are you prepared to run again?
I am. I am prepared to run again. I am running again. We're very happy to be announcing that. And it's, you know, it's we fell short. But, you know, we're in a conservative district that it takes time. It takes work. And I feel very strongly that this is the time, that this is the cycle. We're getting more attention for the foundation that we built in this district, and we're ready to do it.
And what about funding your campaign? Are you pledging not to take any money from healthcare interests?
I did not take any corporate PAC money, healthcare, fossil fuel, any of that last cycle, and I pledge to not take any corporate PAC money this time. That's very important to me. You know, I also don't believe that money determines the winner. That's kind of an old school way of looking at politics. What I believe is you need enough money to fund your campaign, to get your message out, to do it strategically.
And forgive me for asking, but you also have what, like $180,000 worth of debt to pay, if I have that right?
For me this time, it is extremely costly, and I will have to treat it differently. I will be a candidate, to be quite honest, that this year I will be working. I'll be back consulting for different tech companies because I do have this large debt. But that doesn't diminish my passion for this. That actually makes me more keen on doing this because I want to send the message that, look, healthcare is important. Obviously, we need to fix that. We need to do something. We need to solve those problems. But we also need to look at what is the candidate that we're looking for. What is our democracy about? Should it be that way? Should it be that only people that are completely financially secure can run for office and represent us? And with the wealth divide, that's going to continue to be a problem.
And how is your husband? How is he doing?
He's doing amazing. He has crossed all his recovery milestones, and that's why I was able to get to this decision. He's been given his driving privileges back, which is great for me as a co-parent because he can take the kids places. And so, yeah, he's doing great. There is, you know, everyone has told us there's no reason to have any concern. You know, he'll have his checkups. But again, this was not a chronic condition or something. This was a fluke. A very, very scary one. And we're just very grateful for everyone that treated him and worked on his case.
Anita Malik, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Now, if music, or indeed literature, be the food of love, play on. That was Shakespeare, a genius admired by every British schoolchild and writer, including my next guest, one of Britain's most notable contemporary novelists, Ian McEwan. Works such as Atonement, Enduring Love, and On Chesil Beach have been transformed into award-winning films. And all his books are read across the world, joining the likes of To Kill a Mockingbird and Hamlet in Britain's school syllabus. His latest novel, Machines Like Me, is set in a 1980s alternative reality where a robot is part of a love triangle, questioning the impact of artificial intelligence and most especially, as McEwan told me here in London, raising the issue of moral choices. Ian McEwan, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Prolific, very well known all over the world. Your latest is Machines Like Me. And this is where you come to tackle the big, I think, moral conundrum of our time, and that is the automation of humanity. And you talk about Adam and Eve. What brought you to tackle this right now? Why was this the subject of your latest novel?
It's been a lifelong interest. Way back in the 70s, I wrote a television film about Bletchley, and the characters there are talking to each other about whether a machine could think, which was a great preoccupation of the great computer scientist, codebreaker, Alan Turing. And I followed its massive disappointments over the years. But just lately, we were living through a kind of silver age. AI is suddenly intruding on our lives. I heard some parents talking about whether you should tell your children to say please or thank you to Siri or Alexa. There's a conversation you could not imagine 20 years ago.
Does AI scare you or does it fill you with hope?
Well,
in the human form.
Yeah, my mix of it is total fascination and some dread. For example, we've just lost 400 people with a tragic encounter with AI in two airplanes, Boeing 737s. It thought it was stalling. The brain thought it was stalling. A five-year-old child looking out the window could have told you the plane was not stalling. On the other hand, the consequences of this and the shifts in our own morals is going to be an extraordinary story, actually. And we're already exploring it, of course, in TV dramas, and we have been exploring it. Of course, I guess Frankenstein is our modern text for what can go wrong.
You mentioned the air disasters, which, of course, were in Ethiopia and Indonesia, and now those Boeings have been grounded pending some kind of fixing of this AI.
Yeah.
It just shows that the computers are not, you know, the things that we should putting our lives in. It's really quite a dramatic lesson, in fact. I'm interested that this book, it's remarkable how you describe Adam in this book and the couple who come in contact with Adam and how they sort of become a threesome in a very human way.
Yes. I mean, a three-cornered love affair is one of the kind of oldest plots around. So into this rather modern discussion and moral dilemma, I wanted to really see what would happen if we just get really close up to this matter. Is the narrator, Charlie, who buys an artificial human, really just playing a computer game of a very sophisticated kind, having this person in his house? Or is he brushing up against a sentient moral being with full consciousness? So when Adam goes off to sleep with his girlfriend and he's very much in love with her, and they spend a night of shame, what interests me...
Sleeps with Charlie's girlfriend.
She sleeps with Charlie's girlfriend. The main interest for me is, in fact, the morning after. The conversation that Charlie and Miranda have, a row, in fact. Is he right to feel cuckolded? Is he really betrayed? Or, as she says, you know, it's different. This is just a machine. You know, come on, cool down. That's a conversation I feel we might be having increasingly. It's not just whether children say thank you to Alexa or whatever. Some point in the future, we are going to have to confront the possibility, at least, that we've made machines that can actually feel and think.
And machines that feel, think, and have their own moral parameters, their own moral universe, because Miranda then starts she has a dark secret of her own.
Well, Miranda has committed an act of revenge. Adam, I think, is... We might well give our thinking creatures our better natures. We're very good at... You know, we know from our religions and philosophies and our gossip how to be good, but being good all the time is really difficult for us.
The revenge is that she accuses somebody of raping her.
Yes.
Which actually didn't happen.
Yes.
But she is getting revenge for the fact that this somebody did actually rape a friend of hers.
Yes.
And got away with it.
Yes.
And then Adam, the computer, the AI guy, tells the police.
He shops her. And not only might we want to cut Miranda some slack because the man is a loathsome rapist who's otherwise going to walk free, but the future life prospects of a little four-year-old boy are going to be profoundly affected if she goes to prison.
Because she has a kid now.
She's about to adopt this child, but if she has a criminal record, then that could be all over. So I've rather stacked it. I'm interested to know that some people tell me they are very much on Adam's side in this, and others are outraged by Adam's decision. I'm using the old-fashioned techniques of the novel to explore a moral issue.
It's very relevant to our times with the whole Me Too moment that we're going through, and accusations and counter-accusations and who gets away with what. But even in your, I think, probably most famous book, because it was an early one and it got made into a film, Atonement, you tackle the similar issue.
Yes.
About a man falsely accused of rape.
Yes.
And assault. Mm. And what happens to him. I guess, I mean, that was a long time before the whole Me Too.
Yeah.
What is it that sort of sparked your interest in that?
Well, it's extremely difficult because rape is an absolutely vile crime. Often there are no witnesses, and often people are standing up in court contradicting each other. And actually, the system cracks under this. And also, we know that men of power and celebrity and status and wealth have abused their situations. But also, we know that sometimes, you know, we're all human, and false accusations can be made. And there's a danger that accusation can become due process. Yet at the same time, we really need to, you know, check some a historic set of abuses. So I'm not sure there's any easy way through this. And places where there are no easy ways through are places where novelists like to go.
Novelists, storytellers, people who are the guardians of our history and our civilizations. And you're very careful, I think anyway, to pick really important modern day social issues across all your works, whether it's what we've just talked about here, whether it's, you know, climate in Solar, whether it's the Iraq War in Saturday, whether it's, you know, a couple's inability to consummate their wedding night because they don't know, they've never been taught how to have sex and relationships in On Chesil Beach, which is also a film. Is that what you feel your storytelling is that why you tell stories these days? Not just for the great joy of writing a novel, but also to weigh in on these great social issues of our time.
I never really feel that that's what I'm doing. And yes, Solar and Saturday touch on these things, but the intimacy of Chesil Beach is not one of the great burning issues of our time, and a fetus narrating a novel, likewise.
I love that in a nutshell. Yeah, that's an amazing device.
But I take, a somewhat old-fashioned view of the novel, that it is very good at exploring the ethical dimensions. In fact, as soon as a novelist describes two people in a room, they could be strangers or lovers, it wouldn't matter. There's a cloud of ethics around them, because the novelist has to sit somewhere, and his gaze, her gaze, has got to have some kind of moral vantage point. But I don't pick issues. I mean, I'm pretty good at leaving space between novels. I'm very good at not writing. I'm doing it right now. I've got maybe 9 months, a year ahead before I address anything. When I finish Nutshell...
Is it in your head yet?
No idea. Complete blank. I'm a blank slate. And that's where I quite like to be at the end of a novel. So I don't. They just well up, really. They choose me. I don't think. Well, shall I just tick off the major issues of the day? It doesn't feel like that to me ever.
Because you are, you know, 21st century writer, one of the, you know, real handful of great modern British literary novelists. Do you feel like you're also a public intellectual? I mean, we don't really have that in our sphere right now. In other countries, they do.
Yeah.
But do you feel that that's an area where novelists should be, or that you would be, could be?
I don't think I mean, when I think of public intellectual, I think of a man like Bernard-Henri Lévy, you know, or my old friend, late friend, Christopher Hitchens, who was always in there every day fighting battles. I feel I cannot write novels unless I guard ferociously my solitude. So I pop up now and then, maybe with an article in the newspaper, and you know, but then I sink back because I do need this quiet and space around me to live with ghosts, really, these characters that take over my life for 2 or 3 years. Very hard to take to the TV studios or the soapbox and write a novel. For me, impossible.
But you are quite open about your politics. What upsets you, makes you feel really depressed and bad about our world today? What's the worst thing that's happening to us now?
Two things that are colliding, I think. One is that some form of toxic populism has entered the bloodstreams of many, many countries around the world, from Turkey to the United States, including Britain, Austria, Italy, Hungary, Poland. And at the same time, and inseparable from this, is the issue of climate change, because populism does not give a fig about climate change. It is not, it's not in its bloodstream to worry about that. And I think we're at a very important turning point. All our predictions about climate change turned out to be too conservative. I mean, they're actually now we're on an accelerating slope. We really need some brilliant political will to start to push us in another direction. We haven't even begun to inflect that emissions curve that we thought we could. And we've got just the wrong kind of governments in power, who are much more concerned with nationalism, with whipping, but anti-scientific, anti-rational. So they seem deeply related now to me, the more recent issue of this populism and the fact that it is rendering us incapable of reacting to climate change.
I mean, you're known for doing a huge amount of research. Mm. Let's say Saturday, when you actually, one of your protagonists was a surgeon. And I just want to ask you, if you don't mind, can you read from this passage? Do you mind?
Sure.
Okay, that's a passage from Saturday, and then we can talk about it.
For the past 2 hours, he's been in a dream of absorption that has dissolved all sense of time and all awareness of the other parts of his life. Even his awareness of his own existence has vanished. He's been delivered into a pure present, free of the weight of the past or any anxieties about the future. In retrospect, though never at the time, it feels like profound happiness. It's a little like sex in that he feels himself in another medium, but it's less obviously pleasurable and clearly not sensual. This state of mind brings a contentment he never finds with any passive form of entertainment. Books, cinema, even music can't bring him to this. This benevolent dissociation seems to require difficulty, prolonged demands on concentration and skills, pressure, problems to be solved, even danger. He feels calm and spacious, fully qualified to exist. It's a feeling of clarified emptiness, of deep, muted joy.
I mean, I've never heard surgery described like that. It gives such depth and understanding. How did you get to that place?
Well, I'm describing something here which I'm afraid we don't really have a word for. People have talked about flow and some other words, but we don't have a natural word to describe what you, I know, will have experienced is working in a team, solving a difficult problem and solving it, well, sometimes alone, but that's very nice to do it in a team of people, to accomplish something difficult. It's a peculiar kind of joy, but at the time, it's just, you don't even exist, as I say. You know, you're just out of time doing the thing itself. You're completely in the present, and you feel as if you are now, you've earned all the duties and responsibilities and pleasures of having a consciousness. That can happen in writing, but it can happen in cooking a meal. It can happen in a game of tennis. It can happen on a hike. You know, it's one of the greatest human satisfactions, I think, to solve something difficult, to do something difficult, run a mile in under 4 minutes, whatever it is. So that's what really fascinates me. I love those moments when they come. They're very rare. It's 2 hours when you don't, at the keyboard or longhand, where you don't even know you exist. You're so completely in the thing itself. It's such a joy.
I've heard you say that joy, for you anyway, has been somewhat tempered by the addiction that even you have to your smartphone.
I confess.
That these wonderful empty moments and spaces just don't exist anymore because even you have to fill it.
I confess that I look back to the 70s and 80s and early 90s where solitude was much easier to come by. It was a general social good. When I'm asked to give advice to young writers, I say, turn all the machines off, buy a notebook and a pen, and spend at least half an hour a day with your own consciousness and walk through your mind as if through a garden. It's difficult. It really is difficult. But it shouldn't be that difficult because we read books, for example, and that's a way of cutting yourself off from everything.
And the great thing is book reading, real book reading, is actually, it's holding steady and increasing.
If someone had said to me, Christiane, 30 years ago, pointed to my portable typewriter, my Olivetti, and said, one day that machine will be the portal to all knowledge, instant news, every fascinating as well as terrible thing you'd want to know about the world and human nature, and it will be your writing machine, I would have said, not possible. How could it? It's a typewriter. So, you know, I use Freedom sometimes, switch it on. They can't access the internet for 4 hours. It's quite a good program. Otherwise, it just has to be discipline. But with, you know, when a breaking story, you know, if Notre Dame is burning, it's very hard to concentrate.
Do you realize what you've just done? You've just appropriated newspeak, a breaking story.
Yeah.
Normal humans don't talk like that.
Well,
now they do.
Now they do. Now I do.
Well, I just wondered if you could comment on something I heard described. The building is meaningful because, as in Egypt, where Egypt didn't build the pyramids, but the pyramids built Egypt.
Yes.
Notre Dame has such an influence on France, Paris, and our Western culture.
Yes, and, you know, Victor Hugo sort of locked it in time and space forever. And it's lovely to hear readings from the Hunchback of Notre Dame. It sent shivers down my spine. I thought, I haven't read that since I was 18.
You know, so, you realize it went right back up to the top of the bestsellers and Amazon and this and that.
Oh, has it?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
Because of this fire.
Anyway, apart from thinking, at heart, we're Europeans, really, and maybe, you know, we shouldn't be too full of despair. I also thought, any building that's going to last 850 years is going to have a narrative of ups and downs. And in 200 years' time, Notre Dame will still be there. People say, did you know that the roof caught fire way back in the 21st century? And so it'll be absorbed into a giant narrative that's included a huge chunk of medieval history.
When I asked you before what gave you most cause for despair, I want to ask the reverse question.
Yeah.
Of all the world leaders who we see on a regular basis, who's the one you most admire right now?
God, that's really difficult. I mean, over the last few years, I remain full of good feeling towards Angela Merkel. I feel that although she's made some errors and Germany is now facing a crisis of its own with populism and Alternative for Deutschland, I still think she stands as a beacon for the liberal, open, tolerant, democratic society that I treasure and I think is under such attack. When I said this to someone, about a year ago, I was immediately attacked in all our right-wing press. They sort of loathe her, and I felt fully justified at that point. But she's fading. You know, she's no longer going to be around. Mutti, as she's called in Germany.
Mother.
Often headline writers in Germany say, do we let go of the apron strings, Mutti's apron strings? And of course, you know, it is a worrying moment. Had you asked me a few years ago, I probably would have said Obama, although he was not a great decision taker. There was something about the spirit of that man and Michelle Obama that were truly inspiring. Amazing. She's just been at the O2 here. 15,000.
That's the stadium. She does stadiums now
yeah.
and sells them out.
She sells them out. But it's interesting to see. Lots of my friends were at that concert, if we can call it that. And they said how wonderful it was to see so many young black girls there who feel that she's sort of opening up a future for them.
What would you say to American readers, people who follow you and, read your books?
Well, I mean, the institutions of the United States have taken quite a hammering. I don't know whether this storm will last another 2 years or another six. But I think the institutions are sort of holding up, more or less.
You wrote about the Gulf War in 2002. That was a previous American president, George W. Bush, helped by a British prime minister, Tony Blair.
Yeah.
Is this worse than that?
I think that the assault on truth internally to the United States is a real concern. And I think the kind of permission that the Trump presidency has given to others around the world, including Bolsonaro in Brazil, but right across, the strongman kind of notion, is very worrying. And there was a poll here in Britain just last week. 54% of people want a strongman, but they want their strongman. You know, they want a strongman. When they say, I want a strongman, they mean, I want to leave the EU without any more talking and fuss. Well, I want my strongman. My strongman wants to revoke Article 50. And the whole point of a democracy is to save those people from my strongman and to save me from theirs. We ought to have learned that lesson by now. So I would like to smack the bottoms of the 54%.
Corporal punishment is not allowed.
No, okay.
Let me ask you, though, you're talking about truth and obviously the novel and storytelling. You've spoken out quite convincingly against this sort of modern mania of trigger warnings and safe spaces and platforming and all the rest of it. As a writer, as a storyteller, what is the risk with all of that, with people allowing themselves to have these shelters, these actual fake shelters, I would say?
Well, I guess we're talking about the university campus, you know, which really should be...
Well, anyway, we always have to give warnings now of what we're doing on the air and all the rest of it.
But, I mean, when I think, for example, of a reading list or a literary canon, you know, these are the books you should read, the whole point of a reading list is that it should be challenged. But the point of the challenge is you should be adding to it, not taking things out of it. So if you say there are too many white men, dead white men on the list, Conrad, Hemingway, etc., etc., then you should be enriching it, not saying nobody's to read Lord Jim anymore because he has some attitudes that we don't like. That would narrow your reading list down to, there'd only be Toni Morrison, which would be great in a way, but you really want diversity. And the richness of possibility of the exchange of ideas is lost if you start banning speakers. Obviously, anyone who's got hate speech is another matter. But people who disagree with you profoundly is all part of, the imaginative excursion of the project of a university. So, to quote my anti-hero, Chairman Mao, let 100 flowers blossom.
You have said, if it wasn't for the women readers, the novel would be dead.
Absolutely. My son and I once tried to give away 300 or 400 books in a little park outside our house, and we carried them out. And every woman we met said, read that. Oh, can I have that? Can I have three? And any man we approached said, no, sorry, mate, I don't want to. We couldn't give one book away to a man, and it led me to the conclusion that without women readers, the novel would have died long, long ago. Probably wouldn't even have got started.
Who do you read? Who's your favourite novelist?
Why, I think the mental space of the imagination is so vast, so I resist the idea of hierarchy so much. But, I'm a great lover of the American half century, second half of the 20th century. I think it really was the American century for writing. So Updike was a wonderful figure who became a friend in the last 7 or 8 years of his life. We had to stay with him. And Saul Bellow, who I'm rereading at the moment, I know he's got some very unfashionable views, but gosh, does he make the street sing. I mean, the Chicago just seems to hum and throb through those pages. That high-low quality of dealing with ordinary life and the high end of power and intellectual exchange, all on the same page, all sometimes within the same sentence, thrills me. Very hard for us to do that in Britain. There's something still, I think, joyous about the project, at least, of classlessness in the United States that we do not have here. We can have working class novels, but they're that, you know. In the United States, they call it the great American novel. And so my admiration remains undimmed.
That's a great way to end. Ian McEwan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Christiane.
Some literary lessons there from a real master of his craft. But that's it for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at amanpour.com. And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.